Please read the next time certain.
Item 981, authorize $631,321 total in grant funds for the 2019 Cannabis Social Equity Grant Program in the Office of Community and Civic Life.
Commissioner Daly.
Thank you, Madam President. Colleagues, I'm pleased to introduce this next item. Today, we will be voting towards $631,321 for Cycle 2 of the Cannabis Social Equity Grant Program. We'll hear from staff at the Cannabis Office, as well as some of our community partners who've been recommended to receive funding. Before we begin, however, I'd like to take a second to recognize that this will be Brandon's last time before council in his current capacity. He's recently accepted a position at Metro. Brandon, I want to thank you for your steady leadership over the past 4 years and congratulate you on your new adventure. Cannabis policy is largely uncharted territory for local government, but you have risen to the challenge and we appreciate all that you have contributed. With that, I'd like to welcome Brandon Goldner, Kimmy Iuka, and Jeanette Ward Horton to the table.
Madam President. I know we get mixed up all the time. I was going to say, can't we pass a resolution to prevent Brandon from actually going to Metro?
I appreciate that. Thank you. I'm excited and also sad. This work has been incredible and difficult and super meaningful, and thank you all for your support in that and for my colleagues too. So as you know, my name is Brandon. I supervise City of Portland's cannabis program. I'm here to talk today, just briefly before giving it over to our policy coordinator, Kimye Wayoka, to talk a little bit about the social equity grants program and give a brief overview of year one of that program. So if we could begin with the first slide. So the Cannabis Social Equity Grants, it's a tool for restorative justice, community reinvestment, and wealth creation in communities that were impacted by cannabis prohibition, specifically Black and Brown Americans in America, from law enforcement to the judicial system through the laws that were made. Cannabis prohibition disproportionately impacted those people and those families. And in my view, the city has an obligation to do what it can to repair some of that harm. And the Cannabis Social Equity Grants is a small step in that direction. And so that is why we are here today. The Cannabis Social Equity Grants also aligns with the City of Portland's comprehensive plan. We talk about economic prosperity and equity and resilience. And it also aligns with the Bureau's 5-year racial equity plan and the citywide racial equity goals. So again, the entire City of Portland, all of you commissioners, folks who live here, our staff, our community understand the importance of this work. With that, talking a little bit about the first year of the Cannabis Social Equity Grants, and just for some context, Portland voters passed a ballot measure in 2016 that authorized a 3% local tax on recreational cannabis sales. The authorized uses of that revenue were threefold, as summarized in these bullets: for drug and alcohol education and treatment, for public safety investments, and then for support for small businesses, especially women-owned and minority-owned businesses, that language in the ballot measure, and economic opportunity and education to communities disproportionately impacted by cannabis prohibition. And do want to say thank you to Commissioner Fritz, whose efforts it was that bullet point got into the ballot measure. And again, we all understand how important that is. Some background on year one of the grants. And to be clear, that the first year of those grants were facilitated by OMF's Grants Office and by Prosper Portland. Now that we're going to be talking about year two in just a moment, that's being facilitated by Civic Life, but the first year was not. There was a community survey that was done to identify priority areas for reinvestment of that cannabis tax revenue, as convened by Commissioner Fritz and Commissioner Udaly's office. And there's a steering committee that got together to decide, okay, so that third bullet point of the community reinvestment, the social equity efforts, what specific types of programs and efforts should that tax revenue fund? So the result of those processes on the next slide, oh, you have it there, thank you, were three priority areas: expungement and record clearing, workforce development, and small business development and technical support. And there again, you see that a portion of that money was managed by the Grants Office and a portion of that money was managed by Prosper Portland. So the selection process for that portion of the money that was managed by the Grants Office, that $350K for the expungement and record clearing and workforce development, I'm going to talk briefly about that because it's that portion of the revenue that most closely reflects the what we're calling year two of the cannabis social equity grants that we are here to discuss today, authorizing. The process there, we had nine applicants in that first year. The selection committee recommended three projects for funding, and those projects were approved by council in August of 2018. Metropolitan Public Defender for the record clearing and expungement portion received $154,000. GreenHop is a cannabis retailer that has a GreenHop Academy with cannabis-specific workforce program. They received $95,000. And then POIC and Rosemary Anderson High School received $100,000 for their construction pre-apprenticeship program. Now, all three of those organizations have representatives here today. They're going to come up and speak a little bit about their efforts. And so they'll be up here in just a moment. For that first year outcomes, all of those projects are on track to meet the outcomes that were identified in the grant agreements, and more than 800 Portlanders have received services as a direct result of those cannabis social equity grants. And I do want to make mention that in year two of the grants, there is very specific language that talks about aggregate data and analyses of demographic information so that in year two, we know exactly who we are helping with this funding, because that's critical. Yes, we want to do good. We want to allocate funding for that purpose, but I believe that we really need to know exactly who it is that we're helping. So in year two, that is baked into the grant agreement and is a requirement. So I just wanted to make that point as clear as I could. With that, that ends my portion on the first year of the grants. And so now I'm going to kick it over to my colleague, Kine Wayoka, to talk about year two. And one more brief thing, and she didn't want me to do this. I do want to say publicly, Kine has been doing heroic work with this. It is difficult. It's unprecedented. This stuff is new for our bureau. It's new for the city. It's new around the country. And Kine has a level of professionalism and patience and creativity that I wish I had, and I really appreciate her work with this. So with that, I'm giving it over to Kine to talk about year two.
Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. My name is Kimie Wayoka, and I'm the policy coordinator for the city's cannabis program. Forgive me, I'm a little nervous. This is my first time here.
And we're pretty scary looking, aren't we?
Oh, man. I think it's the table, really. Maybe a little bit of the hype thing. As Brandon said, our bureau took over administering this grant fund this year for year two, and it has, needless to say, it has been exciting. Not only did we have a bit of a compressed timeline that we were aiming for, we also received three times the number of applications for the funding as they had in year one. It threw a bit of a wrench into our planned timeline, but we're here. Yay! So upon the recommendation from our grant review panel, we are here today to propose six projects to be funded by the city in year two. This graphic shows the activities of the year two grant making on a timeline. One thing to note that because it was really important for us in year two to get this grant aligned with the city's fiscal year. Therefore, it was decided that we would announce this grant as an 8 to 10 month funding cycle in order to align with the city's overall fiscal year timeline. With your approval today, we will be on track for a 9 month funding cycle for year two. So We started off with a listening session in April. It was a great opportunity for us to introduce ourselves to some of the organizations that are doing the work of these priority funding areas and begin to start to build some community and connections around this work. Threw a pretty broad net out in invitations, and 20 individuals representing 15 different community organizations participated in that listening session and helped us to shape the funding announcement. A link to the summary of that listening session and the action items that resulted from that listening session is available on our website for this grant at www.portlandoregon.gov/cannabistax. We also work closely with the Office of Equity and Human Rights on shaping the final product. The year two priority funding areas, $490,000 was allocated in year two for expungement and record clearing, workforce development. Those two were carried over from year one, and the an additional funding priority area of reentry housing was added for year two. Prosper Portland again received funds, $210,000, to continue small business development and technical support. And Jeanette from New Leaf is here to speak more about that piece of work in just a moment. So our selection process, we brought together a review panel of six community members and one city staff from the Portland Housing Bureau to participate in the review and recommendation process on grants this year. They were not prepared for the volume of work that we gave to them with 32 applications, but they rose to the challenge and donated more than 230 hours of time to this process. So I'd like to take a moment to thank them and acknowledge that, that gift. The review panel process included an independent scoring process, which was then followed by an all-day in-person collaborative scoring session. Of the 32 applications received and the $3 million in need that were expressed by those applications, the review panel landed on a final recommendation of six projects for funding. And they also recommended that all year one projects receive funding for a second year. We're here today to request approval to fund these six projects at $631,321, and we are requesting a retroactive start date of October 1st, 2019 to allow for that nine-month grant cycle. The review panel recommended that the city utilize $141,321 of the currently available fiscal year 1920 funds to allow us to fund the top six applications, which did include a second year of funding for the first year grantees. This leaves $758,679 for the fiscal year 1920 cycle, which we will be calling year three. Projects proposed for continued funding in year two are the year one grantees, Portland Opportunities Industrialization Center, AKA POIC, at Rosemary Anderson High School for their construction pre-apprenticeship program, Metropolitan Public Defender Services for their community coalition record clearing clinics, and Green Hop for their Green Hop Academy. New projects for year two are Southeast Works with their Youth Works project, VOS for their Building Economic Power for Day Laborers project, and Constructing Hope for their Building Equity project. Summaries of all these projects are in Exhibit B of the ordinance packet and will also be posted on the grant webpage after final approval. But even better yet, as Brandon mentioned, representatives from all of these organizations are here to speak to their work and share the impact of their work directly with you themselves. Of note, one year two applicant requested a small scope modification after the review panel process, and it was primarily to increase pay rate for the participants, the pay stipends for the participants. In order to do that, they needed to make a reduction on their internship program, but there's no change to the overall requested amount. So most importantly, what have we learned?
Could you go back to the last slide,
yes,
please?
Yes,
yes. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Madam President. Go through this one again, so we're reducing the 10-week internship from 20 participants to 10?
Yes, so their request was to increase the rate for both their apprenticeship program and their internship program to get closer to a living wage for those participants. They are not requesting funds for anything beyond those stipends for participants. They are contributing the other program costs for that. And in order to make those changes, they increased the pay rate for the participants. They made a reduction in the number of the 10-week internships from 20 to 10.
And is that still a good value for the money that we're investing in that program? If we're getting half of the participants as compared to what was agreed to in the original contract?
I believe that is yet to be seen fully, only because we do not have the year one outcomes yet, and as we have all spoken to, this is a learning process, and we are working to even better define for ourselves what how best to support all of our grantees in meeting our expectations around building wealth and power for these communities that have been most impacted. And so that is part of our process in continuing to improve and refine and shape this grant.
Thank you.
So along that line, what we have learned and what we still need to do, we have received, all of these points are based on feedback that we've received directly from grantees, applicants, and community members, and also our review panelists. So we are continuing to increase our level of support for applicants both before and after the application process. An example of that is everybody who was not recommended for funding this cycle received an offer of a 15-minute one-on-one meeting to discuss the details of their specific application and how that might be strengthened in the next cycle. We are also hosting for year three a grant writing workshop as part of the pre-funding announcement opportunities. We will continue to improve our grant making process. There are lots of things that we can do to fine tune and improve the support that we provided for both through the funding announcement and also to the review panelists. Some of the feedback we have gotten and we are already working towards is continuing to seek out strategic opportunities to make upstream changes and investments to even broaden the impact of these funds and increase communication and collaboration across bureaus, as well as looking for policy opportunities aligned with this work. And also to deepen community relationships and engagement around this work. One of the big takeaways from the 50-plus conversations that I have had over the last 7 months, I think can be summarized in a clear statement here that I'm going to try and communicate. one thing that stood out in all of my conversations was this, that work in reparative and restorative justice requires a thoughtful and strategic plan, and that our policymaking needs to be trauma-informed, and we need to be using trauma-informed policy stewardship in partnership with the communities that we intend to serve. Without these things in place, people, processes, power, all of the peace in all their forms will default to what is familiar, and that will work against us in our work if this truly is our goal with the use of these funds. So we have really taken that feedback to heart, and we are working to identify some clear action items for year three. I will hand the microphone off to Jeanette to further discuss.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioners. Happy to be here. I'm Jeanette Ward-Horton. I'm Executive Director of New Leaf Project, and we are receiving funds from Prosper Portland and from the Social Equity Grants ultimately to support the investment into minority and women-owned businesses, minority and women-owned cannabis businesses. So I'm going to share with you just some information about why this is important and some thoughts around how we can think about the future of these grants. So let's start with this fact, because it's important to ground ourselves in this and ensure we're not coming at this from a stereotyped or prejudiced perspective. Many studies have shown that adults across races use cannabis at similar rates. However, we can see in the next two slides, this is arrest rates, and the slide after is conviction rates in the state of Oregon. You can see the disproportionate targeting of, first, African-American communities, second, Native American communities, and I think it's really important to call out what communities we're talking about specifically so that we can understand, as Brandon says, when we start to get visible into who we're impacting, that we're clear we need to be impacting positively through these funds, African American communities and Native American communities first and second. Conviction rates, if you move forward, get interesting. You still have trends of African Americans being convicted at higher rates, but Native Americans jump up here. So we've got to keep our lens on both of those communities and ensuring that these funds really impact positively those two groups. If you think Liberal Portland's any different, before we move on, it's not. I have arrest records from 26 to 2014 of Portland, and absolutely African Americans are targeted the most. And the Native Americans are actually arrested at similar rates to their population, but nobody else is for cannabis arrests.
Madam President.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you. I am very curious on this data because I think most people know that Hispanic is not a category where we are collecting data in a way that we can actually add to the demographic information, right? My work in criminal justice has taught me that a lot of times Hispanic individuals are misidentified as being white. And so I'm curious as to, because when you look at the chart, you would think Latino community is not as egregiously impacted, but I would argue with that if that was what we were telling people were so. Anybody?
I would also add to that that if you think about cannabis criminalization over time, that there is also data there that we are actively searching for right now in advance of year three to have a sense of the generational, intergenerational impact. And given that the forefront of cannabis criminalization was driven in part by some...
You know, you can just say it, right? From unequal, racially focused criminal justice activity, right?
Yes, we should against not be Mexican-American shy. Immigrants.
Yes, we should not be shy about actually just saying this is what it was, this is what it still is, and this is why we got a lot of work to do.
Thank you. So that's why we are focused right now on taking a look at over time, what does this look like, not just for the past 10 years, but what does it look like for the past 80 years?
Hispanic Americans also, Latino Americans also get classified as black, black or white versus Latino. So you're absolutely right, Commissioner Hardesty. All right, so this is really important for understanding. There's a term called compounded deprivation that a Harvard researcher named Robert Sampson coined that talks about how arrest and conviction really impacts an entire family. It isn't the one individual. The economic impact impacts the mother, the father, the brothers, the sisters, the spouses, the children, and the children of the children. Unfortunately, data is telling us that African Americans are the one group where your children are likely to fare worse than you are economically. And that's not what we want for our communities and for our families and for our cities. And the reason for that you can see here on this slide, because arrest and incarceration results in all of these other things. You can't get loans for businesses. You can't get loans for schools. You're denied housing in better neighborhoods, et cetera, et cetera. And all of those things lead to this web that then leaves you in a depressed socioeconomic situation that gets worse generationally. So what we do at New Leaf is
Yes. I just wanted to correct the slide. I'm sorry. If you'll go back, in Oregon, when people are incarcerated, they cannot vote, but the day they get out, they're eligible to vote. I think there's only one state in the United States that people still don't have the right to vote after a conviction. And so I don't know how you'd want to change that, but I, for the sake of accuracy, because I know many people just believe that once you've been incarcerated, you can never vote again. And so we're trying to undo that myth around who can vote and who can't. Thank
Great.
You.
Great. Thank you. So what we do at New Leaf is understanding these interconnected web that leads to the compounded deprivation is we focus specifically on entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship has been shown to be the best way to improve household wealth. 37% of the wealth in the United States is held by entrepreneurs. And African Americans specifically are in the worst positions of entrepreneurship rates. We own the least businesses, and our businesses tend to be the least successful. And it actually gets worse with cannabis businesses that are very hard to fund and that you can't get traditional funding for. So we see a really great opportunity to take the funding that is available through these cannabis taxes and use it to impact directly the best lever for improving household wealth. If it is entrepreneurship, then how can we take that money and create entrepreneurs who are funded to levels that allow them to be successful? So these couple of stats are to further shore up that point. Various studies, and there's one from MIT here and one for the Center for Global Policy Studies that point out that lower levels of success rates or lower levels of startup capital are the number one impact on entrepreneurship success rates. And we can make a direct impact on that, and we are making a direct impact on that with our New Leaf grants. Here's an example of that in terms of giving you some year one information about success rates. We have granted several businesses, two of which received our quote-unquote large grant of $30,000. And this is an example from one business how they were able to improve their business with that grant. We measure what they do with the money and then how that money impacts the business. And they've been able to hire employees. They've been able to improve their sales, all of which is good for cities. You know, this is the right thing to do, as Brandon said, but this is also good for the city's bottom line. The last thing I want to say is I really want to leave here thinking about year three and year four. Kimye talked about the year three grant amount of $741,000 and some change, which is commensurate with the percentages that are being given across the three places that Brandon brought up before. We've got money going to police, essentially, as the city audit has pointed out, that the public safety amount is essentially going to police, with money going to drug rehabilitation, and then we have money going to these communities that have been impacted by the war on drugs. And 80% of the funds are going to police. So I do want to, before I stop speaking, leave with the commission that that imbalance is not what the voters intended and not going to address the issue we're trying to address. Giving 80% of funds to police really can only compound the arrest and the situation we're trying to reverse. So I'd love to leave in front of the city thinking about the future, rebalancing those distributions.
Thank you. Mayor Wheeler has said that we're going to have a work session in the springtime to discuss that very issue. We are all very well aware of it. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we'd like to invite some of the year one grantees up to speak to their work.
Welcome.
I'd like to invite POIC, MPD, Metropolitan Public Defenders, and Green Hop up, please.
Anyone can start. Just state your name for the record.
Oh, man. It is on me. Hopefully everybody can hear me. Thank you guys for having me. My name is Charles Manigo, and I am here on behalf of POIC. I am the pre-apprenticeship coordinator. I run the pre-apprenticeship trades program that we have going on there. And just real briefly, I don't know if you guys are familiar with POIC. We have been a fixture in the community for over 50 years, primarily in the northeast and north part of Portland, where we specialize in primarily getting African Americans and other low-income minorities job placement, education, things of that nature. The reason I am here is to talk about the cannabis grant and how important it is to our program. And one of the biggest things that it's been able to do for us is help us with support services, which helps for our retention purposes for our program. Our program is 12 weeks long, and once completion is done from our program, our graduates go into state-accredited apprenticeship opportunities. We've served 52 people approximately. Out of those 52 people, excuse me, I have to look at this. 31 have been African-American males, 9 have been Hispanic males, 6 have been African-American females, 1 has been a Native American female, 3 have been Hispanic females, and 2 have been Caucasian males. Of those 52, 43 are currently enrolled in accredited state apprenticeship opportunities, and of the 43, 34 are making $31 an hour or more, and the other 9 are making $23 an hour and more. And the reason that is important is because with this cannabis grant, we've been able to help 7 of our folks get driver's licenses, because that's a huge barrier and a huge obstacle that we face. If our folks don't have driver's license, they may be on out of work list longer than folks who do have driver's licenses. We've helped 4 people with child care, which is really, 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 really huge. We pay our folks by the hour, but it's not enough to cover things like child care, driver's license. We've paid for 4 of our folks' auto insurance because of this grant as well. We've pretty much been able to do anything associated with getting our folks to work. And that is huge, because we have a lot of other barriers and obstacles that we have to face from some of the youth that we serve. And it's the demographic that we primarily target. It's no secret that, you know, they've been marginally affected by the cannabis laws. One young lady, as a matter of fact, was recently, well, not recently, but she was released from prison at the end of last year. She came to us, wanted to be in our program, but she had a lot of barriers. She had recently lost custody of her son because she was in prison. Just her family trajectory was really kind of all over the place, but we were able to reassure her that, you know, we would be able to help her as long as she was helping herself. And because of the cannabis grant, we were able to get her child care, we got her driver's license set up with bank account, we got her set up with financial literacy classes as well, which is something that we just simply wouldn't be able to take care of if we didn't have access to this money. So I don't want to be too long-winded, and I actually feel like this is kind of a big deal. I feel like I'm on CNN, you know. But
you are not quite CNN, but
oh man, this is huge.
Yeah,
but we are really appreciative of the cannabis grant. We hope dearly for the life of our program that this is something that will continue.
Madam President.
Charles, I wanted to thank you for being here today. You did great.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you for kind of illuminating the kind of support services that you're providing, because we know that not addressing these barriers is a huge pitfall to a lot of these programs, mm-hmm. and it's why we see such poor retention rates. And if you're truly aiming to serve marginalized communities or underserved communities, it's not enough to just say, come get the knowledge. Because as you described, there are a lot of barriers to simply showing up.
Yes, ma'am.
So very supportive and thrilled to hear about those 43.
Yes, 43.
That's more money an hour than I made before I got this job.
Oh, man,
so.
If I was making that amount of money at, you know, we serve the ages between 17 and 24. If I was, you know, 23 years old and I made $30 an hour or more, I don't even know.
We'd certainly keep working at that profession, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Madam President. I think the message I'm getting from your presentation, Charles, is having a pot of flexible resources that you can use to address specifically, directly, the barriers that people are encountering is vital to the success of getting people through pre-apprenticeship to a good family wage, union wage, employment opportunity.
Yes, ma'am.
And one question I had for you is that if someone was going to try to do this themselves, there's an $80 fee that's paid to the state police. There's a $265 application fee. Do these funds allow you to assist people in expunging their record?
We have other services within the organization that would allow that to happen, yes. Not particularly pre-apprenticeship, but under the umbrella of POIC, absolutely.
I asked that question because clearly there are some professions that with some of these things on your record you would never be able to get into. Clearly the answer is for the state legislature to pass a law that just expunges people's records across the board. We're not there yet, but until we do that, it is important that we provide all the assistance we can directly to folks, because $345 is a lot of money,
yes,
to
ma'am.
Most people, right? So if you're trying to choose between feeding your family or getting expungement, you're going to feed your family first.
Absolutely.
So I just want to applaud that the work that you're doing and the intentionality around really providing those wraparound supports that help people to just focus on getting the training they need for a living wage employment opportunity.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Who's next?
Hi, my name is Michael Zhang, and I work at the Metropolitan Public Defender. And just to go off the last comment, Commissioner Hardesty, The fees are, as you stated, enormous, and they're actually, in most cases, much more. The $265 filing fee is just per conviction, and the median number of convictions that I would estimate is like three or four, at least. And even, you know, you see people with like many more than that convictions. And so in order to expunge someone's whole record, it, you know, the figure would be like astronomical if there wasn't a fee waiving process in place. In any case, my name is, as I said, Michael Zhang, and I work with the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office in its community law division. And the goal of this division was to establish holistic defense, which is where we would address someone's all of their needs rather than just their need for criminal defense. Our goal is to provide a wraparound civil legal services to people who are or have been involved previously in the criminal justice system. And we believe that by doing so, we can lower barriers to people's reentry into the community and to the workforce. In 2018, we received funding from the City of Portland to establish legal clinics throughout the city to assist people in the expungement of past criminal records. A past criminal conviction, as we heard today, can be a person's biggest barrier to gaining employment or housing, and even higher education. For many, a prior cannabis-related conviction may be their most significant barrier as well. And as we reform our cannabis laws, we're glad to see that there's also funding to help people who had been impacted in the past. This year, Community Law Division, through the marijuana grant and just through the its cannabis grant, screened 1,031 individuals, including 351 black identifying individuals, for expungement eligibility. The criteria for expungement is very complex, and so people are rarely able to understand the law on their own. And so when we're talking about cost, it's not just the cost of the filing fees, but in fact, usually people would hire a lawyer to do this, and a lawyer in the Portland area would charge at least $1,000 to $3,000 to handle anyone's particular case. And it's due to the extreme complexity of the law that's what the market rate is set to. And so we've established clinics throughout the local communities within the city of Portland that have historically experienced the greatest effects of mass incarceration. In this past year, we've partnered with the Urban League and the Miracles Club to host monthly clinics. And we've also partnered with Black Lives Matter, the Emmanuel Temple Church, to host individual clinics. And we've also participated in community events like Juneteenth and Good in the Hood. We also have monthly clinics with the Portland Alano Club and Bridges to Change, and also held clinics with the Pacific Northwest Council of Water Protectors at its medicine gathering at Oxbow Park, as well as Portland Community College. The demand for our clinics is immense, and the people that I meet with on a daily basis are very grateful for the help that we can provide them. In the next year, with continued funding from the city, we hope to build on our existing relationships that we've cultivated. Also, it's noteworthy that Senate Bill 420, which was recently passed, will expedite the expungement process for people with low-level cannabis possession convictions, and we're looking forward to providing relief to these people who are who will have a more expedited process for their expungements. And as we look forward to continuing this work, we hope that the community will see the Metropolitan Public Defender as a stable and reliable partner for providing this kind of service.
Thank you.
Madam President.
Commissioner Daly.
Michael, can you tell us roughly how many people you've been able to assist with completing an expungement?
Those numbers are in our report that we send quarterly. I have our numbers right now for screening, but we're currently working on our final report. We did submit our third quarter report. But it's about I would estimate that the number of people that we screen tend to be about like 30% eligible, which is higher than the than if you were to just find people and like randomly sample people for their eligibility.
So how many have been screened?
1,031.
Okay, great. Thank you. Welcome.
Hello. For the record, my name is Karanja Cruz. I am the co-owner of Green Hop, co-founder of Green Hop, the first hip-hop dispensary. I just want to kind of give you a little bit of context, because everything we're talking about is kind of like reflects or impacts what I experience. Being black in America is hard. First of all, Green Hop was created just through a sense of bootstrapping, no capital, just two single parents from Portland, Oregon. I want to emphasize being from Portland, Oregon, because the cannabis industry is full of people who are not from Portland, Oregon. So I want to emphasize us being born and raised in Portland, Oregon, also being educators, being in the educational system, and just pretty much bootstrapping. Not able to access capital, not able to access loans to be able to start the business. And we started with nothing. And we were able to build it up by ourselves working the business and saving every penny so we can be able to hire our next employee and then the next person. And so literally we started from zero and still are building up with no capital. So it's scary. In a sense, we don't have any type of safety net. We just have to keep going to be able to continue to build. The way the grant is set up, it's set up through an invoice system. So it's hard to be able, just to answer your question with the 20 to 10, it's hard to be able to have the capacity to be able to bring on 10 people or 20 people right away, because we don't have the capital to be able to invoice that after the fact, if that makes sense. However, I was told to talk about community reinvestment and shifting the narrative, so I actually wrote a whole speech. I'm just going to read the speech, and then we can just dialogue if you have any questions from there. But Green Hop's programming honors the histories of communities of color, particularly African Americans, cultivating a pipeline that provides a stake in the multi-billion cannabis industry as entrepreneurs, investors, consumers, advocates, and employees. What the city of Portland is doing with the Cannabis Social Equity Program is a model for the nation to see. The purpose of the Cannabis Social Equity Grants is to address the lasting impact of disproportionate cannabis enforcement impact communities by providing economic opportunities, increasing access to housing, reducing legal barriers for housing, employment, and education. As the cannabis industry is slated to grow nearly $21 billion in 2020, Green Hop Workforce Incubator Program will lay the foundation of an economic shift of low-income families of color while offering black and brown individuals a unique opportunity to shake off the decades of historical underserved access to job growth and prosperity. Green Hop's programming would also specifically help repair the harm caused by disproportionate criminalization. Being a licensed teacher that is currently working with educators and students now, I'm still noticing the school system is not preparing us for today's workforce. Now being on the other side, being a teacher, now being on the other side of providing jobs, we still have a system that is, a school system that is preparing us for the industrial system, where we are literally in the digital and technology revolution in the beginning of it. So schools have not transitioned, and I can literally see the reflection of schooling and how it affects the workforce today. So it's quite interesting being on both sides, but we have a lot of work to do. And having programs like this literally helps organizations like Green Hop, who literally started from the ground up, who is bootstrapping everything and literally needs help to be able to provide services for people.
Thank you. If there aren't any questions, I'm going to call up our next panel. We have Chris Kendricks from Southeast Works, Osmani Alcaraz Ochoa from VOS, and Simon Collins from Construction Hope.
Thank you. Welcome.
And we're running a little behind, so.
I'll just go first and get right through it.
If anyone can tighten up their testimony, that'd be great.
Okay. Good morning, city councilors. My name is Chris Kendricks. I'm the youth coordinator at Southeast Works. Thank you for having this opportunity to speak to you this morning about the Cannabis Social Equity Grant and Youth Works program. So Southeast Works' history serving justice-involved individuals dates back to 1997 in Southeast Portland. Since then, we have served thousands of Portland residents with employment, education, and training needs. In 2018-19, we served 8,600 customers with 23,000 served, of which 25% self-attest to prior justice involvement. Funding for Youth Works will provide education, certification, work experience, occupational training, mentoring, and employment placement services to 40 low-risk youth who are 18 to 24 charged with drug or property crimes living in the City of Portland Neighborhood Prosperity Initiatives. This is including Lentz, Rosewood, Cawley, and J Division Midway. We will deliver services through a positive youth development framework that draws upon research evidence-based practices of the Department of Education, Oregon Youth Development Division, including its 2016 position paper and 2017-19 Juvenile Crime Prevention Guidelines. PYD emphasizes building skills and attitudes important for youth resiliency, capitalizing on individual strengths and assets. A trauma-informed approach will be utilized given that 80% of justice-involved youth have history of trauma. Motivational interviewing will be used to build rapport with clients, tapping into their internal motivation. MI, used with the justice-involved population since the 1990s, can lead to improved retention, enhanced motivation to change, and reduce offending. Research on justice-involved youth show that lack of employment is one of the biggest predictors of justice system involvement and unsuccessful reentry, and that access to employment and job training can help youth avoid a lifetime of negative justice-related consequences. Southeast Works intends to disrupt that cycle through a hands-on relational program model that will result in positive outcomes for youth. On behalf of the Southeast Works Board of Directors, staff, and youth, I would like to thank you, City Commissioners, for your support in this very important work. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Madam President. I'm curious, you've connected drug and property crime. Folks with that background, why the property crime connection?
Why the property crime connection? Because I feel like there's a variety of crimes that are out there, but I feel like we're covering all bases of the crimes. It don't matter any crime, any time that we'll help with.
I guess as it relates to the cannabis funds, mm-hmm. right, we're mm-hmm. really focused on making sure that the people who've been impacted, and but when you talked, you said drug and property crime.
Yeah.
So your whole, the organization yeah. will yeah. work with anybody
yes.
with a criminal background?
Yes, anybody.
This particular program, however,
mm-hmm. And drugs, yeah.
Excuse me?
And drugs, yes. I said, and drugs and property. So we're saying with everybody. That's what we do.
So are the so is there a different demographic that has been over-criminalized in property crimes rather than folks who've been over-criminalized with marijuana convictions and how marijuana laws have played out?
No. We're mainly focusing on African-Americans. Yes.
Speaker.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Osmani Ochoa. I am the executive director of WOS Worker Rights Education Project. First, in April, 15 workers went to Legacy Emmanuel to plant trees with the Bureau of Environmental Services. This also brought together Verde, Friends of Trees, and Trecology. There were two plantings. One of the workers that participated said, every time I go to that hospital, I will think of those trees that I planted there. The cannabis grant will extend opportunities like this for low-income, houseless, and immigrant workers to work together with city government on meaningful community projects that deepen workers' skills and allow them to be seen and respected for their contributions that they make. We believe we are building a practical training model that will be replicable as the Portland Clean Energy Fund picks up steam and trains workers of color to rebuild the city in more sustainable ways. Secondly, the Workforce Development Program out of came out of a request of the workers to sharpen their skills, and there is a full range of skills development opportunities on site at the Martin Luther King Jr. Worker Center. From work-related language classes to safety trainings, including OSHA card opportunities, to on-site workshops that have included gardening, restoration, construction, salvage, janitorial, and even recycling plastic for 3D printing. We are working with the Oregon Food Bank, Pacific Northwest Carpenters Institute, Oregon Tradeswomen, Master Gardeners, East Multnomah Soil and Water Conservation District, Portland of Emergency Management, Metro, People, Places, Things, Reuse, and Cascadia Clusters. The Cannabis Grant allows us to continue to bring training partners to the Martin Luther King Jr. Worker Center and provide on-site, hands-on, and popular education-based workshops, and develop the intercultural skills and connections of those organizations as well. Third, a key element of the Capacitaciones model we offer is that we're not just training unskilled workers, but we have a model to identify the skills that are already within the worker community. Many of the workers at the Worker Center come to us with skills and for whatever reason are unable to put their capacities to work in the way that they'd want to. By using our model, we can identify those who have skills and are ready to lead others and help prepare them to whatever their next level is, whether that's matching with more skilled opportunities to getting their contractor's license. This model is flexible and highly customized and can be used by other organizations to track capacity and progress among marginalized groups. At our site that includes Latinos, African Americans, and African immigrants, as well as poor whites, people living with mental health and/or addiction, and those formerly incarcerated. To conclude, the Cannabis Grant was designed to rectify injustices because of racially biased criminalization and enforcement of cannabis laws. Members of our community are among those impacted, and the model has the potential to reach beyond the communities we serve on the corner. On behalf of VOS, we thank the city for the continued opportunity and your commitment to right historic wrongs. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon. I'm Simon Collins from Constructing Hope in Northeast Portland. We are a 10-week pre-apprenticeship training program that takes people who have no experience working in the construction trades and gives them enough experience to join an apprenticeship so that they can move on to a lasting career that makes a living wage. We primarily work with people coming out of incarceration, focusing specifically on Black and brown men in the Portland area. And we provide a lot of wraparound services for our students. We provide, with partnership with other organizations, referrals for housing, referrals for daycare, referrals for clothing, referrals for tools, referring for boots. We provide boots. We have a food pantry on site, because what we find is when people are coming out of incarceration, they come out with almost nothing. And I think that the best way, I think, to show kind of what we do is to tell the story of one of our students. We had a student whose name was Robert. He had spent 8 years in prison for various drug and property crimes. When he was released from prison, within 2 weeks, he was given custody of his 7-year-old daughter that was born when he went into prison, and he had barely developed a relationship with her, and suddenly he was her full-time caregiver. He had no job, no money, no driver's license, many thousands of dollars in fines, as well as time that he needed to do in community service, and he was overwhelmed. He came into our program. Our program is 10 weeks. It's unpaid, so you have to devote yourself to being there 3 days a week for 10 hours a day. We start at 6:30 in the morning because that's when construction jobs start, so we want people to get the experience of actually having to be at a job site at 6:30 in the morning. He showed up every day. He had perfect attendance. He became a leader in the class. He was just amazing, but he was still homeless, living on somebody's couch with his 10-year-old or with his 7-year-old daughter, like just really struggling. And so with our partners, we reached out through Human Solutions, and he was able to find an apartment. Through a pre-apprenticeship childcare initiative, he was able to get childcare for the time that he was in the program. He was then able to extend that child care through DHS to be able to have child care for a year. He got into an apartment, got his tools, got his boots, got his job. The day he graduated from our program, he got a call from the iron workers, and he started work a week later making $22.31 an hour. He's been working steadily since then and is, in fact, getting custody of his second child very soon because he's actually become something he thought he never would be, which is a stable living environment. He comes back into our office all the time and asks what he can do to continue to promote our program in the community. And what he's done is we've had three other students that have come through the program since him that he has caught literally 2 days after they get out of prison, some of them, moves them into his house, if it's okay with their probation department, he follows the rules, but he moves them into his house, gives them a place to stay so that they can start the program because he so believes in what we're doing that we can be able to move that forward in the community. And we're just very proud to be here in Portland and being able to do the work that we can. In last year, we had 65 previously unemployed Oregonians that we helped get into full-time work, working in a trade where they can make an actual career. We thank the council for considering this grant because it will just continue to help our program grow, and it will continue to do the good work in Portland that we're doing now. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're all doing amazing work. And now I'm going to call Brandon and Kimmy back up. In case council has any questions.
Seeing none.
How many people do we have signed up to testify?
We have three people.
Okay, thank you. I don't think there are any questions. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
I do have one question.
All right, Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Madam President. So my question is, I know that this is new, and I know that we're putting systems in place. What we've heard today is really encouraging about how community-based organizations are really using these funds to really invest in people in a very holistic way. If you could wave a magic wand and say, if I could do X, we could either expedite the process or we could actually help more people. What would the X be that if you could do would improve the outcomes of these investments?
I will briefly say funding and staffing are critical. I mean, for so many of these services, the more the city can put the onus on itself, on its budget, on its staff to help people navigate these processes so that it's not complicated, it doesn't take all day to do. I think the city has an obligation to do that. So I would say, those two things.
I would add to that anything that you, as the city council, can do to encourage increased collaboration between bureaus. Oftentimes, I have found myself kind of reaching out to a peer and then asking for support upward in whether it's gathering data or finding out about what another bureau is doing. And so just kind of anything that you as council think that you can do to support that increase in strengthening the communication and collaboration between bureaus with this grant outcome in mind would be helpful.
I look forward to the work session that we're going to have, because I think that's when we can talk about really whether or not the investments are being made in the right place. Somebody mentioned 80% of the dollars going to police. That certainly was not what voters had intended, certainly not what the city council plans to support, I believe, moving forward, based on our conversation. So, Brandon, good luck. The great thing about being at Metro is that we partner with Metro, too, so might be able to help each other. Thank you both for the work that you've done.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please call
the three who signed up are Lightning, Charles Bridgecrane Johnson, and Maggie.
So since we're running a little late, we're going to go to 2 minutes.
Yes, my name is Lightning. I represent Lightning Super Data. I'm probably the only one in here since it's been legalized. I do not smoke marijuana, so I'm not your customer, but I did stand alongside of you when you were denied the waterfront permit to legalize cannabis and made sure you had that right to do that. Now, my position is the policymakers have missed it. We're in a saturated market. I'm asking a reduction from the 3% tax down to 1% to make sure the growers are subsidized at this time because you have miscalculated overall on this market. Issue number two is that I agree on the grants. Everybody get your money. I do have a problem with the first go around on ongoing past that point. I think there were 32 applicants. There's a need for $3.8 million. I think other people should be involved and rotated. My main issue is on these grants, I'd like to see more health-related grants given to people that understand the effects of marijuana, can educate the people. It should be your choice, even though it's legalized, just like alcohol. I'd like to see more of the neuroscience approach to understanding how that affects your neural pathways and understand how that affects the gray matter and understand that neuroscientists are doing studies on this and they do have some concerns. I want to see that data brought forward again, not to stop the legalization or your business, but to have an informed, educated way of making your final decision if you want to use these products or not, just like alcohol. So again, from the city hall, your number one concern should be the health and the safety of the public. I did not hear you mention that once on any of these studies, and I point the finger at Commissioner Fritz, and I'd like you to review some of these studies, and I'd like you to get back to the committees and go over this.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, Charles Bridge Crane Johnson, and it was great to see the city working hard on this program. I would like to encourage the people that came up and spoke to keep engaging with the city and pushing, as Commissioner Hardesty mentioned, this possibility that up to 80% of cannabis tax revenue is funding things in the police department at a time when the city of Portland is closing community centers is problematic. Hopefully we'll have some exact facts come out about where the whole cannabis tax revenue breakdown comes out. The thing that I think would also be helpful for these entrepreneurs is, to the extent that the city is allowed, is more public information that's out there. It's not really, in my opinion, the best government practices when we sit up here and quietly say an anonymous, unnamed place has decided that there's so many barriers and challenges that they should half the size of their pool down to 10 so that those people can be adequately served instead of going crazy trying to serve 20 people. That business needs to be, can be named and supported. The reason it's important to name and support businesses like the only one I think that was a specific business that got mentioned was Green Hip Hop off of, or I can't get the name right, but they know who they are. And they're off Killingsworth. Thanks very much, Commissioner. Off Killingsworth. But that leaves me not knowing, having to dig deeper to find where is the black women-owned dispensary that I can go to, because I don't want my money going. I mean, people need jobs at Sarah Dispensary, but some cannabis dispensaries are multi-state major corporations. And we need to talk about that, and we need to, as a city, live our values and support local cannabis. Even if the local cannabis dealer has to buy from a big multi-state farm, is not positioned to deal with, the city is intimately familiar with the cannabis business since we fired Nathan Howard out of the mayor's office. But let's get the real data out there so we can patronize these businesses. Thank you.
Hi, Maggie, Portland Homeless Town Hall. I agree on stop giving the revenue to the police, and I also agree on the health-related grants that Lightning talked about. Also, supporting small local cannabis business owners is a great idea. Also, I want to talk about the intersection of housing discrimination and cannabis use. Now, In 2019, the GOA, that's the Government Accountability Office court decision, said that HUD contractors were not increasing their social equity in housing as they were mandated to do in 2013. A while back, the JOHS is the local HUD, you know, entity, and they need to be more proactive about getting people into housing who use cannabis for health-related reasons who are disabled, because it's not just minorities, it's poor people who are disabled. And I was able to help one woman, a white woman who uses a walker and a wheelchair and had been using cannabis for 8 years and had never had any trouble with the law. And she was in a shelter because she used cannabis to manage her condition. And so I helped one person get housing, and the JOHS helped one person. And we need to have the JOHS go to the contractors and say, you cannot discriminate against people who are disabled, who are using cannabis as their medicine, because as we know, Nancy Pelosi, the pharmaceutical companies, they want to keep medicine expensive. It's out of reach to people who are poor. And a way to help people who are poor afford their cannabis is charge people more for recreational use and help people discount it or give it free to people who are low income and stop discriminating against them in housing.
Thank you. This is an emergency ordinance. Please call the roll.
Udaly.
Well, first I want to thank all of our presenters today and staff, of course, for their work on this program and for their service to our community. Our work on cannabis policy and civic life demonstrates that the way to create a just future for all requires recognizing and repairing past harms. The grant program is an important component of this restorative justice work. I will continue to advocate for a larger share of the cannabis tax dollars, as I have been doing for the last three budget cycles. I agree that too much of it is going to the police bureau, and I have gone on record more than once expressing my extreme frustration that that money is going to traffic enforcement and hasn't bought us 1 minute more of enforcement on the roads, which is really the only area that I could remotely justify in investing these dollars in. But unfortunately, these dollars have supplanted money in their budget and have not increased their budget and have therefore not increased enforcement, and I find that unacceptable. I also have repeatedly called on the state to take action on expungement. I don't think it's reasonable that the city and local nonprofits and individuals bear this burden to correct laws that we've now decided to overturn. And I appreciate Bill 420, but I'd like to see more action at the state level. I want to ensure that Portland continues to make meaningful investments in the communities that have been disproportionately harmed by our racist drug laws. I want to thank the Civic Life team for all of your efforts to strengthen this program. It's encouraging to see an increased number of applicants, and I expect that this will only continue to grow over time. I also want to thank the many Portlanders who continue to dedicate their volunteer time to provide invaluable input through community listening sessions and serving on our grant review committees. I want to give a special thank you to Jeanette, who has been a tireless advocate for the equitable cannabis policies, and to my appointee on the committee, Rayko Hillier, for her ongoing work to advance justice for all. Finally, I want to thank my staff, my colleagues and their staff, for their ongoing support of this work. I'm pleased to vote aye.
Fish.
Commissioner Udaly hit all the bases, so I'll simply add, thank you, Commissioner, for your leadership on this matter as well. Aye.
Hardesty.
Thank you. I also want to add my appreciation of really the hard work of civic life and actually really fleshing out this program. Brandon and his team have just been remarkably visionary. I think we can do better. I think with the work session, with us making sure that we're really investing in the right things and making sure that we are supporting the whole person to get their records clean and opportunities. Quite frankly, I don't want us limited to just construction. There are a lot of living wage employment opportunities that we should be helping people have a path towards. Great work so far. We've got a lot more work to do, but it seems like we have a lot of intentionality about who should benefit and how we make sure to hold people accountable for that benefit. I vote aye.
Fritz.
Thank you for a very, very interesting presentation. When I led the campaign to pass the tax in 2016, the City Budget Office said, just put it in the general fund, don't earmark it, don't do anything special, it'll pass. And that's what most of the jurisdictions around us that passed this local option tax did. We, working with the Office of Neighborhood Involvement at that time, decided that we wanted to be specific that this tax should benefit people who've been disproportionately impacted, and public safety and transportation safety. And I actually question the statistic of 80% going to police, because I know that half of the annual allocation goes to Vision Zero for physical safety improvements. But anyway, I'm really glad.
80% didn't sound right.
No. So I'm glad that we're going to have the work session in the spring to discuss this. Thank you, Brandon Goldner, for all of your work on this program over 4 years. It was really interesting setting it up with you and your predecessor, Victor Salinas. And it's a new thing. It's great when government can do something from the beginning and be really intentional about it. Kimi Urioka, you seem like you are really ready to continue great work on this program, so thank you for that. Thank you for your presentation. Thank you to Jessica Rojas, who's my a representative on the committee, to Claire Adamsick, my staff, who helped set it up 5 years ago when we were thinking about how to do this. It's been challenging, interesting, at times very frustrating, and at times really hilarious. So thank you very much, and I'm really pleased that what we were hoping to have happen, as we heard from all of the people who testified today about the good that's happened in the first year of funding, that was why we passed this tax. Thank you. Aye.